Hello and welcome to the Modern Maker Podcast for July 18th, 2019, otherwise known as National Caviar Day. All right, let's take a bet of who here has eaten caviar. I got definite money on Ben.
Are we betting or do we just say?
Oh, we don't have to put money on it, I guess, but I say Ben's a yes, Mike's a no.
No, I have tried it before.
Oh man, I'm the odd man out then.
It's not gross, but it's not anything that I would seek. You know, if it's there, you might as well eat it because you might as well indulge in rich people things.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely not going to go hunting down caviar. Like that episode of Frasier where they get hooked on a really, really good batch of caviar, but it ends up being controlled by like the Russian mafia or something like that.
Oh, man.
It's a classic.
A classic Frasier episode.
Yeah, I never thought I'd throw it back to a Frasier episode on our podcast, but
we should start a segment.
Shout out to the early 2000s.
Frasier talk. So let me apologize early on in this episode before we, I'm sure Ben has some thoughts on caviar, but before he does, there's a, that we, I talked about it probably 3 months ago, the ceiling construction that's still going on. So you'll hear some nail gunning going on in the background. And also on behalf of Ben, you can hear people, a body falling from scaffolding right now in the background, probably. Ben forgot his or lost his mic cable, so he's on a pair of headphones today.
Yeah, so audio will be a little bit compromised, but hopefully we'll still get through it. Caviar, huh?
Here we go.
I'm not the biggest fan. I've had it, and I think I've had fish eggs more often in sushi places than anything else than just eating more like Russian style caviar, but. I think the thing that's always funny to me about these kinds of foods that are seen as sort of weird by one culture is that I'm always surprised at the number of people that think what they eat is somehow like objectively determined as being like the smart and like
yeah, like chickens are normal
way to eat things. But like hot dogs.
Yeah, this is the normal group of food. Everything else is weird.
No, you got to grind up all the pig's assholes and ears and then put them in this tube that barely feels like it's an organic material. And then, no, that's normal food.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for me, the oddity would come from just that, like, it's so expensive and that it's like this delicacy. But if you take it in a vacuum, it's not actually better than a hot dog.
Right. Well, I still think that, like, if you actually think about just what's weird in terms of, like, how and where we get it, I mean, we eat chicken eggs, we eat chicken, we eat fish. It makes sense that we eat fish eggs. But I still think, like, honey, if you really think about it, is kind of strange. Like, there's not too many – if you were to go up to anyone and say, like, hey, what's for dinner? And you're like, well – let me not tell you about the main course, but let me tell you what we're going to do, right? What we're going to top it with. And we got these little insects, and they're industrious little dudes. And we're going to like harvest this weird kind of excretion that comes out of their heads. And then we're going to smear that onto something else. You'd be like, no, thanks. I'm good.
Yeah, well, I've always thought the exact same thing of just about an egg. Just the first person to try an egg was a ballsy dude.
Dude, the first person to try anything was just hungry.
Yeah, I gotta eat something.
And they ate a lot of more stuff.
Yeah, I'm gonna be straight up though. I think the foods y'all were talking about, it's a weird thing to go for, but there's nothing weirder than the guy that decided to start drinking milk.
Yeah.
Because he just went down there and was like, well, let's give this a shot.
that might be even, well, that's right up there with the bee honey, I guess.
Yeah, that innovator might have also just been like discovery through creepiness.
Yeah, I guess at least there.
And then he had to go convince everybody, no, really, guys, it's not that weird. It's actually pretty good.
Just like mom used to make. Oh, that's disgusting. All right, let's quickly change this into what we're working on.
Yeah. Well, Ben's been gone for a while.
He's
going to have a real story. So, Chris, let's hear yours.
I'll be
let's
quick. Hear the, yeah. I finished up that coffee table. I just started on a desk that Michael Alm will be in. So, it's Monday right now. He's coming in later this morning, and we're collabing on a couple projects. So, I'm building a new desk, computer desk for myself, and he's going to build the sort of like... I call them filing cabinets, but I don't know, the drawers that like tuck under a desk, I guess.
Yep.
So yeah, just got a pretty cool design worked out. It's got a sort of, it's a similar design to other desks that you've seen out there. You'll understand when you see pictures of it. But when I was looking at it, like from the side, I noticed like, it looks a little chunky and I wasn't liking it. So I came up with this idea that's these sort of like impressions or like debossed areas that give the illusion of the legs continuing up past the tabletop. I know this is hard to understand, like, in these vague terms, but hopefully it comes out cool. And if it does come out cool, I feel like it's one of those sort of like aesthetic things that can branch off into a lot of different projects.
It's a new signature move.
Yeah, a new design language.
Whoa. All right. That was whack. Get out of here.
Okay, fine. Signature move.
Yeah, there we go.
I'll go with yours.
I don't really have too huge of an update either, other than the concrete river table that I talked about planning on doing last week is complete. And holy crap, boys. This thing is certified? Amazing. It is so cool. And it worked really great. What did you say, Chris?
Is it certified? Banging?
It is. I hope so, man. I really hope so. I'm crossing my fingers because it looks great. It's a simple DIY. And I made a steel base without welding.
Yeah. I saw your story where you were doing that with two-part epoxy or?
Yeah, it's a product that Gorilla makes and it's called Gorilla Weld, but it's metal epoxy similar to JB Weld. They're occupying the same kind of product space.
Okay. I forget, last time that you did a no weld table, was it the same sort of thing or what were you doing last time?
It was close. So last time I was doing a no weld metal base, but it was using aluminum tubing. And my thought on that is you can machine aluminum with the same tools you can work with when you're woodworking. You don't need any extra things. Right. And then basically what I did is I stuck a square dowel through the inside of the aluminum so I had wood that I could attach screws use, you know, mechanical hardware with.
Right.
And so this time I'm able to use real steel and I'm just using these little angle brackets that you can get in like a 10 pack at Home Depot. And I'm basically using the angle brackets as the main connector pieces, and I'm clamping everything up just with spring clamps. So I'm able to get a steel base using that epoxy stuff, and the only tools that I use to make it is an angle grinder to cut everything and spring clamps to hold everything together. So super minimal when it comes to tools. It's not super labor intensive. It's a little more time intensive just because you're waiting for different little assemblies to cure, but it's got a fast cure time. It only takes about 30 minutes to kind of reach hardness, but full day for a full cure.
Right.
So it's been going really great. I'm really excited about it. And the marble chips that I used on the inside, I remember mentioning I was really nervous because they had pretty big rocks. The marble chips were all the way from 1/4 inch in size all the way up to 2 inches in size. So I sifted out the biggest pieces so I could just get those out of there. But what I was left with was a pretty big aggregate still. And so I was nervous that was going to make everything not split down the center like I wanted or just generally compromise the integrity of the top. But I was able to stand on it 2 or 3 times, give a little hop on it before it broke. So the tabletop is definitely sturdy, definitely strong. The base works really well. And, you know, I think it's just like a good start. I definitely plan on doing another river table, but it'll be an IKEA hack. That's all I'm going to say. I'm going to do a concrete river table IKEA hack.
For this one, so is it concrete, the concrete that you made on the outsides and then what's on the inside, or is it the other way around?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
So, you know, when I picture a river, so is it like, what are the different materials that make up the top? Is it all just concrete?
That's true. Okay.
Are you using resin?
Here's a real question for you guys. Can it technically be a river table if I don't use resin?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the original ones are glass, I guess.
Exactly. Everybody is giving me so much crap whenever I've been posting things on stories because I'm not using resin. They're like, it's not a river table if you don't use resin. But my thing is, the guy who invented river tables didn't even use resin.
Well, those weren't real river tables.
You're right. Yeah, you're right. But no, I don't want any epoxy in that void. Basically, you know, I split the slab in half and then I just kind of separated them about 6 inches, 4 inches, somewhere around there. But I like being able to touch that concrete edge. I don't want to encase it in clear concrete.
So it's just split apart. It's just hollow.
Yeah, it's just split apart. Gotcha. But those marble chips show through. So it looks weirdly like natural or organic rather than like some kind of formed thing. It almost looks like a machined stone.
Right. Maybe you're almost doing it like a live edge concrete table.
Where the live edge is in the middle.
The live edge is in the middle like a classic river table. Yeah.
How about we call it a fault line table?
Whoa. You know, that's not actually a bad idea. Yeah, let's keep running on this for a second.
Copyrighted. Hey, this is copyrighted right now, making it official. I'm suing anybody who makes a fault line table.
Yeah, Mike, I got a piece of paper that I keep notes on, and I put fault line table, and then I did the TM.
There you go. Then
the little TM in the corner.
Just mail it to yourself, and you're done.
Perfect. No, okay. So yeah, let's keep going on that. So you got like some kind of fault line idea. What else could it be? Because yeah, it is almost geological and it's very natural looking, that live edge. So I'm trying to figure out the right way of classifying it, because apparently River Table is confusing based on the amount of people that messaged me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that to me it makes sense, because to me River Table just means like there's something, like it's, I just picture two things split apart and then something going down the center basically.
Exactly. And so I'm thinking when I'm titling the video, that's just what I need to do, because that's what people are Googling and, you know, it's just, it's the right thing, but maybe it's not. So any listeners out there, if you can beat the fault line table when it comes to naming this thing, let me know, because I don't know, man, I came up with something new looking, so it might as well have a new name also, but that's pretty much where I'm at. The one thing that I do have noted here is I need to mention, last week, whenever I was talking about the paver patio and we were talking about patterns, me and you, Chris, had no idea.
Herringbone and chevron.
Yeah, we knew chevron and herringbone were different, but we couldn't figure out what it is. A chevron pattern is cut basically with a miter on each end, so that when they meet at a V, it's basically like a classic miter joint, whereas a herringbone, they're still rectangular pieces. They're not cut, and so they just sort of overlap.
They're staggered.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So there we go. A little fun fact for the listeners.
Boom.
All right, Ben. You've been gone. You've been in Rotterdam?
Yeah, Rotterdam.
Wait, were you about to go off on something else?
No, I was going
to
talk about your white concrete table. It's funny, the first time I did a white concrete table, I was working on a different test for concrete on a slab, and it got cracked, and it was an accidental crack, and so I did that sort of kintsugi thing where I put the gold in the crack to sort of highlight it. Yeah, I like the idea of thinking of it more as sort of some sort of geological thing, some sort of fault or, you know, geological split or something like that.
Yeah,
totally.
I think the word fault is a strange word for people to read, and they still think of it more of like something like, you know, who's to blame than necessarily immediately thinking like geological. But an earthquake is a little too dramatic. But I think there's something along those things.
Tectonic plates table.
And I do think sometimes it's nice to just realize that something can look good and you don't have to cover it up and do another step. You'll get a lot of the comments of like, oh, bro, you should have done this. Oh, no, you got to do this, right? And they won't really know why they're going to do it, but it's just because that's what they've seen before and they're... reflex is just to tell you what they've already seen. But when you ask them, why would that make it a better thing? People often don't have an answer. So you be you, Mike, and you make the table you want.
I will. But yeah, it's that idea of also, I went to Home Depot looking for some sort of concrete sealer, because I know that'll be a common question with it being white concrete and all. Mm-hmm. People will wonder what happens when you spill coffee on it, all of this. And so I walked up Home Depot's aisle, tried to find a concrete sealer that seemed applicable, and they had one for driveways, but they didn't have one that was low gloss. They were out of stock on that one. So I just decided, hey, I'm not going to seal the table. Maybe I'll do it later on if it ends up going in a living room somewhere. But right now I'm basically building it as a prototype, as a proof of concept, or just a test. And so it's what you're saying is I'll link to a concrete sealer in the description that you can pick up at Amazon, but I'm not trying to wait on it to ship here. I want to be able to get that video out as soon as possible. And the value add for the video is the process of making the river table.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's something that I definitely picked up from your videos, Ben, of like keeping to what the core of the idea is, expressing and explaining that, and then kind of moving on, like not wasting time with steps that aren't pertinent. You know?
Yeah, for concrete like that, I think the one thing that I might try, which isn't a concrete sealer, would be just a clear acrylic spray. And so you could do a really light coat. I use paste wax a lot, but that will definitely slightly darken or yellow. And for something that white, you want it really, really kind of porous. Even a lot of the concrete sealers are, you like kind of water them down and you wash them into the surface with layers.
Yeah.
I think that will still give it kind of the two of a wet look. And again, when you're dealing with something that's so white and matte right now, that any kind of liquid sealer is going to make it look permanently a little bit wet and tacky. So I'd say if anything, a spray-on clear coat would probably be the way to go, just so it can like lightly mist the top, and then you can kind of keep sanding it. It's funny, normally people want a real penetrating sealer for the concrete because they're thinking about, oh, what if you spill motor oil on it and all these things? But if you're talking about it for table use, you're talking about worst case scenario red wine, not something that's going to be sort of really sitting on it and soaking in.
Right.
Yeah.
So I would say like a clear acrylic seal will, you know, will seal just as well. It won't seal as deeply into it, but it's that penetration is what's going to give you the kind of darker color anyways. So
yeah,
I would just try to mist on like a nice polycrylic type aerosol spray.
Yeah, I might give that a shot. That's actually a really cool idea.
And with it being water-based too, you could do everything.
Yeah. And the good news is I've got plenty of concrete scraps that I'll try it on the scrap first. If it works good, move forward. Yeah. Awesome. But I dig it.
Yeah. The paste wax and the typical things are all going to not be great for that. I know what you want, that sort of nice white matte powdery finish.
Yeah. I mean, I want it to look like there's no finish. Exactly.
You know, I don't think I've ever heard anybody refer to concrete as scraps. And so now I'm picturing, like, do people who work with concrete have, like, a scrap bin?
Yes.
Like, I'll be able to
use this piece.
My overpours.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Overpours would definitely be it. Okay. So I'm back in Joshua Tree. Rotterdam was 3 days or 4 days of busyness. Met a lot of really interesting other influencers. I met a guy that's basically like British Mike, who's like a really big, like kind of more lifestyle, like daily vlogger in the UK. Like his name's Alfie something. And, you know, he's got like 8 million followers or something like that. But he just basically looks like British Mike. It was really funny.
His name's Alfie Deyes. How would you say a name
Alfie
like that?
Alfie Deyes or something?
Deyes. There we go.
So there's about 40 other influencers. I think I was the only kind of maker person. Oh, there's one girl that's a painter, a couple graphic designers, a lot of photographers, and then fashion kind of people. And this general sort of lifestyle people. Mostly people focused on Instagram. The other cool people were the Harry's twins. So Jack and Finn Harry's are... They're really interesting guys. One's a documentary filmmaker. The other one's in graduate school for architecture. They have really big followings and are really focused on climate change and environmental initiatives. So it was great to sort of talk to them and hear what they're doing. They're doing some incredible work. But that part
What are they working on?
Well, Jack is working on more films that are kind of about sort of climate change, its impacts and what can sort of do about it. Finn was just finished up undergrad and is now going to grad school for architecture. And I think he's working on a couple projects in Africa, sort of, you know, low-cost housing kind of things. Very idealistic, very cool people. And yeah, it was interesting, this sort of group that Mini assembled. I think there was only like four of us from the US, but like sort of 40 people overall. So it was fun just talking to, like, you know, YouTubers from Italy that do videos all in Italian, and they're talking about, oh, you know, this is what our audience is and this is what they like. And so that was really fun. And it's just a reminder that there's so many people out there that have massive audiences that you've never heard of that are doing a completely different thing that's focused on a totally different niche. It's a reminder of how big the world is and how many different little pockets of culture, and everyone just thinks what they're doing is like the norm and makes sense and is caviar. So that part was all fun. The car was interesting. I mean, it looks just like a Mini Cooper, but with like a lot of flashier kind of modern futuristic kind of embellishments that I think are sort of befitting an electric car. It was interesting talking to the design team, and they're talking about, like, you know, by switching it to electric, it's not just like switching it over. You have things like, oh, we don't need exhaust pipes. We don't need these things. What do we use with those space? How do we reconfigure? How do we actually increase the amount of like trunk storage space? And, you know, how much of it is a complete redesign versus like altering an existing design to be electric? It's a pretty radical overhaul when you think about how different an electric engine is versus a, you know, combustion.
Out of curiosity, they're using, I imagine, sort of like the same chassis as a classic Mini Cooper? Or are they doing a complete kind of frame up different design?
It's pretty much a frame up different design. I think the wheel spacing is the same, but the you know, the front and back end is a little bit different. And just the nature of the way the sort of, you know, I think the chassis also accommodates the engine mounts and stuff like that. I'm not, don't hold me to that. I'm not a car guy, but so I think it's a pretty elaborate redesign. The other thing that they're really thinking of this as a car for a city too. And so they're building in these interesting kind of sharing devices. So they really like the idea that a group of people could co-own a car, and you have like a built-in way that you can sort of just block out time on an app and be like, oh, I'm using the car this time to this time. So, and the reason why they want to launch in Rotterdam is because Rotterdam is just like an awesome city of like efficient transportation. It's so progressive. It's amazing how well people utilize like bikes in that city. Like it's such a major, I think you often, Americans think of people that ride bikes as like kind of like poor people, or it's like something that happens in like developing countries because of a lack of money. But it's also just a really efficient way to get around a well-designed city. And they move people around in these bike lanes so safely because they're dedicated and protected from the vehicular traffic. And the pedestrians respect the bike lanes, and the whole thing just flows. It was cool to see a dense city have traffic move that sort of freely.
Yeah. So did they have like a full-size lane compared to the cars? Or was it still like half the size similar to in the U.S.?
About 75% of a car lane.
Cool. Yeah.
But they're awesome on either side of the road, so it's like still directionally specific traffic.
Oh, yeah. I feel like that's the important part, right?
Yes.
Because if you got people competing for the same lane, that's when it gets congested, or like just havoc starts happening, you know?
Yeah. So havoc got to explore Rotterdam a little bit, saw the cube houses, which is something I'd always wanted to see in person, which is those weird houses that are kind of raised up off the ground, and they're like cubes on their, I mean, there's a lot of buildings that are like cubes, but they're normally flat on one side. They're normally not up on a pier on one of their corners.
Yeah, that was really rad. But people live in those.
Yeah. Yeah, they're like normal housing. They're like it's like an apartment complex. And then on the bottom floor, kind of underneath, they almost create like an umbrella structure for a courtyard. It's
nice.
It was pretty neat.
But is it also kind of like a touristy kind of spot?
Oh, yeah.
In a way when like an architecture tourism kind of place to go.
Oh, yeah. There was influencers there.
That's got to be weird to be living in that place. It's like, dang it, the influencers are here again.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of places like that. I mean, there's a lot of streets in, well, if you live in a street
like
in
San Francisco
where they shot Full House, I mean, all day
long. Oh, yeah.
Or if you live
or if
on
you're
the
in Brooklyn.
I think they're called Painted Ladies.
Or where the bridge is. Man, yeah. I remember that whenever we were down there. There was like just an entire street with like 80 people all taking pictures of each other. It was nonsense.
Just
yeah, like if you lived on Lombard Street, I think it's called, that's like the real twisty one in San Francisco. Yeah. Like if you wanted to go to McDonald's, would you be like, damn it, 45 minutes just to get off the street.
Yeah. No, man,
McNuggets.
You'd get a bike.
That's true.
Or if you live in the shipping container house and people are always coming by, and I'm always seeing pictures of people poke around through my Ring camera, the security camera.
Oh, you do?
Yeah,
like people, is it people that just like see it and like, this looks interesting, or people that follow you?
I think it's both. Yeah.
How long does it take you to get to a McDonald's? That's the real question.
Question.
All right. I don't think there is a McDonald's.
What? All right. I know what business we need to go into.
We don't have one.
Joshua Tree needs a McDonald's.
But for what I've been working on, I just published the concrete chair video that's doing nicely. I've done kind of melamine molds before, but I think I've kind of got the system refined from where I used to be. And the big thing that I don't use anymore with any sort of concrete molds is screws. Everything's just hot glued now. And I find that when I hot glue it together, I'm more likely able to reuse the mold making materials. So that's always been the self-critique I've had of my concrete stuff, is that it's affordable, but it creates a lot of like waste volume for if you toss all the mold materials. So
that's a good point. So on this concrete mold that I did, I didn't mean to cut you off, I used pocket hole screws, and I did that like on the most recent concrete forms I've done. And that's made them a little bit more reusable, but there's still a little bit of kind of wear and tear just from the screw being used. So yeah, that's a cool idea. Are you just using normal hot glue? Is there anything like anything special?
Normal hot glue. And I just took a bunch of scrap pieces of plywood, like little, like ones that have corners, right angle corners, and just glued up a bunch of braces. And that actually helped
there
me,
you go.
Hold it.
That helped me keep the walls all vertical too. It was
that's
like,
a cool that's a idea. Idea. Yeah.
So it was like, I made a bunch of triangular squares and used those to glue up the side panels. So I'm both getting it nice and perpendicular and reinforcing the mold all in once.
And I like that.
Just not having to unscrew or find access to a screw head that might be covered up with a little bit of overspill on the concrete is really nice. I just run a knife along the hot glue to kind of loosen it, and then I just tap it out with a rubber mallet. The other thing, though, that I didn't do, but I immediately thought of afterwards, how often does that happen, is I think I'm going to start pre-sealing the edges of the particle board when you cut the melamine. So I might take a little bit of silicone and just smear it on that just to protect that end grain. Because when water gets into that, the whole thing swells up, and that's what keeps the melamine from being reusable. So yeah. I think the next time I do it, I scraped this melamine, so there was no waste in the melamine. I saved all the foam that I broke out to use as an infill for another one. But I think that's going to be – it's weird. Like, you don't have to solve all the problems at once. You kind of just have to keep identifying and keep noodling on it. And then, you know, eventually over time, if you repeat a process, you just keep tweak, and making little discoveries about what works. The other thing that I've been thinking about, and so again, this is a crowdsourced opportunity to help me out here, is I really think inflatable inside pieces of concrete molds would be effective. Where, you know, if you make something that's basically like a pool toy, like a blow up pool toy, I'm pretty sure it's relatively doable to do that. You have like some sort of soldering iron type thing. You have to put a little valve in so you can blow it up and then cap it off. But I think I've heard that people just make these kind of things with like hot glue guns and shower curtains and stuff.
So would this be like instead of the pink insulation that you used on that one? Okay.
Yeah. So one, I think you could make some very Michelin man looking kind of like chubby furniture using inflatable molds.
Nice,
but also I just think the process would be really cool to see too, of like you inflate it, you pour into concrete, and you deflate it. So I think there's ways you could almost do like a quilting pattern. Like if you've ever seen the bubble wrap, like the fancy bubble wrap that almost has like a wave pattern to it, or a you know, has a more complicated cellular pattern with more robust kind of a structure. I think there's some interesting ways to keep taking these like basic concrete objects, just keep making the molds and the process more interesting. So that's been fun.
Maybe there's something to be learned from like the bouncy house industry.
Exactly. Because
they create a lot of like weird shapes, and you know, they have to make a, I don't know why the first thing, I should have said like Mickey Mouse or something, but the first thing that popped into my head for a character to be on top was Captain Crunch, which you would never have, but that would be an awesome bouncy house.
Have a Captain Crunch bouncy house.
Captain Crunch.
It's just because we're recording in the morning and you're hungry. Yeah.
I guess. Yeah. I want some crunch berries.
But I like how you referenced a bouncy house industry. Like there's a whole industry.
Big bouncy
I mean, I'm sure
house.
There is, but I love it.
Yeah. There's just like one factory in Taiwan or something, you know, like it's not
pretty
that much of an industry.
Yeah.
But now I'm back working on, I finished 3D printing all the parts for this new polycarbonate cabinet that I'm making. So today I'll be starting to paint and finish and hopefully start getting on assembly for some of the parts for that cabinet.
Very cool. I'm excited to see that one come together. I've just been seeing stranger
things.
Futuristic but almost Art Deco-y pieces being printed for the past couple weeks.
That's what we're going with. Futuristic Art Deco.
Yeah, and I've got no idea how it's going to look when they all come together, but it's like some kind of weird, it's going to be some kind of weird like Transformer thing. I'm really excited for it.
It's funny. Like, you know how it kind of goes in waves where you're like, sometimes you'll look at your numbers and you'll be like, oh, okay, I got to do some bangers. And other times you'll be like, oh, I have this idea, I just want to do it.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about it and I think I'm just going to mostly just do whatever I want and not focused on trying to find the most popular stuff. Because I was kind of doing some sort of bookkeeping type math, and the way it kind of is now, and this is, again, this is a luxury and a privilege, but the income difference between only putting out like the most popular stuff and doing exactly what I want is pretty negligible when I actually sort of factored it out. Like, oh, if I went this route and every video was doing over 200,000 views, which I could do by kind of like hitting up these things, this is what sort of results income wise versus like if I throw out a bunch of ones that kind of fall flat. The other thing that I've noticed is it's starting to inverse. I'm seeing like a strong pattern. The ones I tend to think are interesting that don't do well on YouTube tend to do really well on Instagram now.
Hmm.
So that's been something I've been trying to think about, and like how I sort of balance those two things. But yeah, I'm excited for this cabinet. It's just like, I don't know where, how it sort of fits being sort of futuristic 3D printed Art Deco, but it looks really cool.
No, it does. Oh wait, yeah, because we also forgot we've titled this style Space Age Japanese also. So a Space Age Japanese futuristic Art
Space Deco.
Space Deco. Ooh, that's not terrible. Yeah. That's actually not a bad idea.
That's not terrible. I like that as like a loving reaction. Like, ooh, that is not terrible.
Not terrible.
It went from it went from like a very high to a very tampered enthusiasm quickly.
It's not terrible. It's great. Yeah, well, I'm with it. I'm excited to see it. But Chris.
Yes, sir.
Last week, you solicited for topic questions or just things that the audience wanted us to answer.
We did our best, lightning round last week. And people seemed to really like it. So we still have some more questions. So I figured we could just work our way through some more of those and hopefully get to highlight everybody who wrote in. So I'll just jump right in. The next one comes in from J. Pete Rasiv, I don't know. I'm not even going to try anymore. Says, if you had one less project to build before you died, what would it be? Sorry for being so bleak. I think there's an obvious answer. I was going to say, a casket. That's what I was going to go with.
Yeah.
Which is similar to the urn. I don't want to know that I'm going to die, but if I am going to know, that'll be the silver lining, is that I get to have a sign off on YouTube.
Honestly, if you could get like a 2 weeks heads up, just like, hey, bro, just so you know, clock's ticking, that would be honestly pretty nice.
You know what? Give me 6 weeks because I want to make this thing a banger for sure if I'm going out with it. I'm going out with a banger.
Because I think the common scenario is, do you want to know when you die? And then I think, and that's with the idea of it knowing like however many years in advance, whether it's, you know, 40, 60 or 80 years in advance. Right. I don't really want that. I want to just keep living life, but I would love like a 10-day to 2-week heads up.
Well, you know what's weird is I've thought about this before. Like if somebody told me right now, like you're going to die when you're 85, I feel like it would spark a change in me where I'd be like, holy crap, I got to finish these things before I die. When it's like, you know, you are going to probably die, you know, best case scenario, somewhere around there. So you should be acting like that anyway. Like, but you just act like, since you don't know, you just act like, I'm never going to die.
You know, Chris, that's some good motivational stuff right there. Yeah, you're right.
Everybody listening, you are going to die. Get to work.
Clock's ticking. Clock's ticking.
I don't know if it's the project I would focus on because I really wouldn't care. But if I was to design a casket, I would do it vertically, right? So one.
Just go straight down.
So, mine's going to be super angular.
Well, I would design, I would actually do the whole graveyard. And I would design it so, one, it just doesn't take up so much damn room, right? Like, you don't need to lay people down on their side. It should be, like, stacked, like they're standing up like a badass, right?
Yeah, their heads so just below
also,
the ground.
Also, from a digging standpoint, you could just have a big auger. Out. You should just be it would be, like, cylindrical. So I would probably just do,
do a tube.
Right.
Vertical pills.
So I would probably do a giant cardboard tube because, you want to be biodegradable. Like, it doesn't make sense to bury all this metal and plastic into the ground. I wouldn't do the whole embalming with formaldehyde because that just, like, pollutes everything. And it doesn't actually preserve you. The whole embalming thing is just, like, dumb. Like, it's a big waste of money. It's terrible for the environment. And the person still rots to nothing anyways. So
that's why I'm all for cremation, man. I'm getting turned into dust when I'm gone.
And then mixed into a nice concrete.
Yeah, there we go.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
But it's space sufficient.
I'm going to build a trapezoidal casket and call it Dead Larry.
Nice.
So I think I'd probably just from a resource efficiency go with the same sort of, you know, cremation kind of space efficient. But if I was to do a burial, I would design it vertically so you could just drill holes into the ground, drop some cylinders in there, let people sort of biodegrade and compost away. But
I like, in terms of like you should open up a graveyard, Ben, with this idea.
That's actually a decent idea, yeah.
And the headstone could actually be your head sticking out of the ground.
Ooh, you know what? I'm off now. Actually, I gotta take away my endorsement.
How logical of a graveyard would that be? Whereas just like, I mean, obviously people would have to be buried much lower, but it's like a bunch of busts just sticking out of the ground with like 3D printed concrete faces.
You take a 3D mold of their head while you're like, instead of embalming them, instead of taking the time to embalm them, you just take a good mold of their head, give them a bust, and send them on their way.
Don't just put my name on it. Put my likeness up there.
That's not... Yeah, you know what? I don't think it's not where the idea needs to be, but I like where you're circling. You're doing a good job here.
Right, and it would be so much more space efficient. You'd get so many more people in there. So you give them a little bit more of a personalization touch, easier to recognize. You're not like reading all these different like flat, boring tombstones. But yeah, so that's how I do that. But in terms of last project, because if I knew I was, you know, if I knew I was on my way out, I wouldn't really care about that. I'd probably try to focus on something that I actually thought was important. So my last project would probably be focused on affordable housing.
Boom. There we go. You know what I do wonder? Okay, well, I just got to go back to this graveyard idea because it's not a terrible idea to go back to not a terrible. I got to switch off of that. I don't know why I'm defaulting to that. You think there's some kind of laws or restrictions that doesn't let you get buried in a concrete tube?
There's probably a lot of standards.
Cardboard.
Yeah. There are some standards to it, but I think, I think I was listening to some podcast and they're talking about it, how the mortuary industry kind of lobbies to make things more complicated because it kind of protects their business. But there's this new trend for environmentally responsible burials where they don't use all the chemicals and they use caskets and stuff that decompose and are designed to kind of biodegrade.
Yeah, we got to come up with a cool name for that. Pods.
For the death vertical. Pods. Death verticality. I don't know. We'll think of something.
And I've got it. The perfect marketing move is you throw some seeds in the dead guy's pockets so that in a few years, once it's all some trees grow up or some little petunias.
Yeah. Die on your feet.
So when you get that, question.
When you get that like week long notification, hey Mike, you got 1 week left. You'll just snort a bunch of poppy seeds and get ready for the great beyond.
All right. The next one comes in from DJ Shmoo. I don't know if he's an actual DJ. Says, always wanted to know Star Wars, Marvel, Lord of the Rings, or Harry Potter. Which do you like?
Chris, let's hear yours, dude.
So honestly, none of them. For me, I haven't... Star Wars, my brother was always like super into Star Wars, who's 2 years older than me. And I think that made me not get into it because I just remember him like watching it all the time when I was three or whatever and me not wanting to watch it. Yeah. And so I've always kind of been opposed to Star Wars because of that. The Marvel movies, I don't think I've seen one or two of them. I don't even remember. Like is Iron Man a Marvel movie? I think I saw that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings, I saw the first two. I should probably go back and watch those. I remember not really caring at the time. Same thing with Harry Potter. I remember my wife, then girlfriend, wanted to watch those. And I remember we were watching them, and she fell asleep, and I continued watching it. And then on the second one, the same thing happened. I was like, why am I watching this? And I turned it off. And then I've heard people tell me that, like, oh yeah, the first two movies were not that good, but then they get really good after that. And I'd actually kind of be interested to like listen to that as a book on tape while I'm working or something. So if I had to get into one of them, I'd probably start off with Harry Potter.
Well, Chris, I've got good news, man.
Yeah.
The two that you are interested in are my top two. Harry Potter kind of came out right in my youth. Like the books were being released as I was going through elementary school.
You're the
so
right
it was
age.
Perfect. Yeah. Because the Harry Potter books were so big, but they were still easy to read that we had this thing. They were called AR points. And I don't know what AR stands for, but I bet reading is the second part. Maybe advanced, like academic reading.
But what it was
with school, you would get points for different books, and Harry Potter books would give you a lot of points. Ooh. And then if you got enough points, you would be invited to the group of kids that read enough books to go to a pizza party at the end of the year.
You know, I think Seven still has that at his school.
It is honestly a strangely effective incentive, I feel like, for kids.
Gotta get that pizza
in elementary school.
I'll work for a year for some pizza.
Yeah, it's just like pizza and M&Ms and all the things that you normally aren't supposed to eat. But it's great. So Harry Potter is good, and it's exactly right. The third movie is when they start getting legit. The other two are definitely geared towards kids a lot more. Okay. They're great, but I definitely say Lord of the Rings over everything else. Lord of the Rings is just like best series ever made. It's incredible.
Incredible stuff.
But The Hobbit is whack. Get out of here with that Hobbit movie. It's too much CGI.
What's your pick?
I think it's really interesting how you can like Lord of the Rings, but not The Hobbit. And I totally get it, but it's hard to kind of put your finger on what exactly is the difference, right? Cause it's the same sort of, you know, the look and feel is kind of the same. Something about it just doesn't bring you in. It doesn't feel like it has the same stakes. It just feels additional and not as like additional, but lower quality.
Big time.
I also think it's like, these movies are so important relative to the time that they came out in. Like the first Lord of the Rings series when it came out was so sweeping, and the landscape cinematography was like beautiful and sprawling that it was, for me, it was like, oh, it was the first time where they took something that was more from like a fantasy, kind of like Conan the Barbarian kind of genre. Not that those things are similar, but from this kind of like sword and magic kind of genre, but then took it really seriously, where it's like, you know, we're getting amazing actors and things like that. And I was sort of confused. I'm like, is this a serious movie or is this like an action movie? Because I had always sort of grown up thinking that there was like serious movies and then there was these kind of like, you know, popcorn movies.
Right.
And I think that was the kind of the thing that really stood out to me about Lord of the Rings. Star Wars has always been my favorite aesthetically. Like, I just think that kind of futuristic, but not polished, plasticky kind of sports center set looking future, but a kind of gritty future that isn't, and then at the same time, doesn't go as bleak and dystopian as Blade Runner has always appealed to me. I always thought that Star Wars was really good at portraying something that seemed livable and kind of worn out. Not too synthetic. It's still acknowledged that in the future, people might still use leather and like animal hides mixed in with, you know, really advanced composite and synthetic things, which I think is, well, which we see now is clearly the case.
Right.
People will wear space age materials on their feet and wear cowhide that's not that different than leather from, you know, hundreds of years ago.
I never thought about that, but yeah, their future aesthetic is very different. It almost looks like as if like you had something that was sticky and then like you just dropped a bag of random pieces of hardware on it.
Right.
It's just got like bolts and stuff just like sticking out of everything.
Also, there, I think with so much of the kind of space comics and stuff like that, there was always this really heavy assumption on everything being streamlined and really aerodynamic, which becomes less important when you're traveling through a vacuum. I always thought that I always liked the kind of that Star Wars was really good at not making spaceships always just look like sleek torpedoes with like stripes and that were shiny. They had this kind of very like asymmetrical, weird kind of lumpy shapes mixed in with some of those kind of more aerodynamic ones.
Yeah.
So I think just from it's a great source of like design inspiration, not from the iconography and saying, hey, I mean, although I've done, you know, Death Star doorknobs before. So, but I think there is sort of an overarching aesthetic that could be sort of like a futuristic modern type. So I think that part, like visually, I think Star Wars just is the best, or it has produced so much original kind of visual ideas. Marvel, I think, is fun. And I just from a storytelling standpoint, I think stretching something out over, you know, 20 films is just so impressive. And to just dominate the popular attention span like so well is pretty incredible. And the movies, I think, are fun. But Yeah, I would say Star Wars is probably the one I think I get the most excited for.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, man, Marvel movies, man, they just don't do it for me.
Yeah, they're just not you.
Not quite. They're a little, I don't know. They're great. They're good. It's impressive what you're saying. To be able to make 20 movies occupying the same universe, especially in the sort of narrow window that they've been able to do it in, it's crazy impressive. But I just think they've kind of hit that like peak saturation to where I think most people are just kind of excited for what's next. You know, not in a negative way, but like we've seen the superhero kind of thing go as far as it can go, I think. And I'm curious what comes out of that. Because I bet it's going to be something that's very serious, a lot less lighthearted and gritty, almost in the same way you're talking about Star Wars, where the Marvel Universe is dynamic and everything, but it's built so much on almost like, you know, I think we've talked about it before, where you sort of like lose stakes in scale when everyone has the most amazing superpower and can't die, or is the strongest person in the world. Right. Or, you know, when you've got the Hulk punching Thor in the face, how much does that hurt Thor? And how much is he stunned by it?
Right. You start to lose scale. So I think it's like, you know what's weird? In a weird way, I think it's the same problem with making content with 3D printers and CNC machines. Is that
right?
The minute you go to kind of like, you know, galaxy scale superpowers where everyone can just shoot laser beams and has unlimited strength and is also indestructible, it kind of reduces the stakes of the fight scenes.
Yeah.
Whereas a movie like Fight Club, I feel like every punch feels like, oh, so gross and so subversive. Yeah. And no one's getting blasted across, like, you know, a football field while they're getting hit by a steel beam or something.
Yep.
So, yeah, I agree. It loses that. And I think that's the same challenge when you do content with a 3D printer. It's like, oh, if it becomes too much of an easy button, how do you actually still apply stakes to it? And I think that's what's good about the Marvel movies. And they do it with, you know, a million little tricks to kind of actually make, oh, this person seems in danger, or this person is strong, but this person really, really, really strong. So I think there's always, in any sort of media, I think there's something, at least for what we do for a living, there's things you can pull from it. The way they sort of keep people into it, the way they set expectations and then break them and then make you think that this is going to happen and then give you a little bit of a twist. Obviously, we're not doing that extensive plotting. Our stuff is more straightforward and linear, but I still think there's a lot of little lessons to learn from. But that being said, I'm going to give an extra bonus obsession. And have you ever seen the movie Dragged Across Concrete?
No, I've never even heard of it. Good?
Well, it's like the opposite kind of movie as a superhero movie, where it's like a low stakes heist movie where they're trying to steal like maybe a couple $100,000, which I think is like a really cool genre. I think that's the answer to after superhero movies where they're like, you know, hitting each other with planets. How do you, if you can't go more than that, right? If you go past the Godzilla stage, how do you sort of pull back and find it? And I think it's like really interesting, relatable heist stories where it's like, you know, two guys that aren't geniuses trying to steal like $100,000. I think that storyline is actually like a really compelling one. But Dragged Across Concrete, I don't know the director's name, but he did that like Brawl in Cell Block 99, which is just...
Oh, yeah.
That Vince Vaughn one. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did.
That movie is dark.
Yes. Yeah. What was the one that they did, Law Abiding Citizen or something like that, that was almost reminiscent of that, but that took it to like the next degree.
Yeah, Brawl in Cell Block 99. It's like, I was like, oh, it was, in some ways, it's equally unbelievable as a comic book movie, but it's also so gritty and realistic in a weird way. It's sort of surrealistic, where there's like elements that are incredibly gritty, like the sound effects of like a bone breaking and stuff like that is like very detailed and realistic. And there isn't a lot of like background music. It's just really flat and like gross. But then the actual just absurdity of the amount of violence is
Kill Bill.
Right. It's like Kill Bill, but like really flat and unstylized, but that almost becomes the style itself. So Dragged Across Concrete is one with Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn's also in it. And
awesome.
It's pretty good. I liked it. I think it's on Amazon. So that'll be that. Cool. I think is like the opposite of what we were talking about, but kind of where I think at least my interest would sort of turn after seeing, you know, peak comic bookness.
Nice. Chris, let's go to your obsession now. I think that's the perfect transition.
Okay. I actually don't have anything, but I'll be honest. Okay, so since you mentioned this AR pizza party, I've been kind of thinking about that. And I think the reason... So my first thought was, well, what happens to the kids who didn't read all the books? They just don't get to go to the party. So then I started feeling bad for those kids. And I probably sympathize with them because I was always a terrible reader growing up.
Get out of here, Chris.
So I was thinking, okay, well, why didn't those kids read the books? So it's either, I would guess, probably one of two things. Either they're a bad reader, like I was, or maybe both, their parents are not pushing them to read the books, which means that they're like kind of at a disadvantage because they don't have parents that are keeping on them to, you know, like when you're a little kid, it's basically, I think that's the most influential thing in your education is what your parents have you do and make you do.
Right.
So I feel like those kids are like disadvantaged and I feel bad for them because they're being punished because they're disadvantaged. They don't get that pizza party. So I want to give those, I want to give some pizza to those bad readers.
Well, hang on, Chris. First off, it's an incentive. It's not like a thing. It's not like you're getting punished by not getting a prize. You don't get punished if you lose a game of basketball.
I think you would look at it if you were a kid that didn't go to the party. You'd be like,
Yeah. And then okay. So basically the way it works is I think it's like the last 2 hours of the day on whatever Friday that is or something. Everybody that gets their AR points goes to the pizza party and everyone else gets stuck in class. And I guess what the teacher should say at that moment is, y'all should have read. And then next year, hopefully they read because they remember that feeling. I didn't go to the pizza party every year and it sucked when I didn't.
Did they at least show you a movie?
No, you just keep going to class.
Hopefully so one, I think reading's overrated. And that's
I was a terrible reader.
Well, reading is just cigarettes for your eyes. It's bad for your eyes. Like, you shouldn't be reading.
False. I disagree.
So I read a lot as a kid, I mean, because we didn't watch television. And I think what you read is way more important than just sort of reading in general. I think there is something about sort of, you know, living in sort of an imaginative world where you have to sort of create it out of words that's useful. But I think, you know, you can get just as much educational value out of watching a good movie as you can reading a good book. That being said, like, I've read a lot and I still enjoy reading. But it's funny, though, like, you know, we would stay up, you know, we'd go to the library, haul back a bunch of books, and then, you know, past our bedtime, you know, be reading under the blankets with a flashlight. And it was, you know, because we didn't have, you know, iPads and phones and stuff. But when I think about it, I was like, oh, that's probably like really bad for eyesight.
To throw in the face of that theory, I was a terrible reader and have the worst eyes of all of us.
That's true.
Chris needs audiobooks.
Yeah, then my ears would be shot.
Yeah, no, I think you're on something, Ben. I definitely would say that I learned more or I was inspired to do things more by like watching the Discovery Channel than reading books like Mythbusters and Junkyard Wars and BattleBots, shows like that whenever I was a kid. Those were definitely, I would say, more influential. But I don't know, man. I think reading is important because that just unlocks the entire world's knowledge to you. You know what I mean? If you can read well, if you can comprehend well, then that means you can go Google something and actually absorb that knowledge rather than just read the words. And if you're capable of doing that, then you can know anything in the world, you know?
I don't disagree with anything that you said. I agree with everything that you say, but I think there's a tendency to kind of act that like reading is good and like watching YouTube has a pejorative, right? And what I think is really important is that we kind of get past that. Because you could ask someone that, like, listening to podcasts isn't all the same. There's incredibly detail-oriented educational podcasts that are well-researched, providing incredible journalism on a specific topic or insight into a subject, or even just tell an amazing story that you otherwise wouldn't have come across. And then there's podcasts that are complete nonsense. And then there's stuff like what we do, which is somewhere in between. Sometimes we talk about, really specific technical things, and other times we just riff on pizza and tacos, which has been the episode that I've gotten the most like follow-up comments about.
Yeah.
that was controversial. No, a quesadilla is definitely more like a pizza. Sorry, chill, bro.
There's something I've been thinking about lately.
But yeah. Deeply. I think it's such an easy crutch to be like, oh, what are you doing watching YouTube videos? Well, there's YouTube videos that are incredible that I've learned a lot from. And then there's other ones that are just time filler and funny and entertaining.
Yeah.
So I think it's really just it's gotten to the point where there's good versions on all platforms for all things. I mean, obviously, there's amazing books that have been written. But there's also a lot of – I mean, you could say, oh, I'm just doing a lot of reading. And if you're reading romance novels, it's like, okay, who cares, you know?
Right.
You're right.
I really think that people keep acting – in a broader thing, people are like, oh, well, that's just how people are on Twitter. No, people on Twitter are the way people are in real life. It's just manifested on that platform. They're still real people. They're not – oh, I mean, there might be bots in Twitter's case. But I think people love to use, you know, types of media or platforms to try to prove a point or to make as if they're all one thing. And I think that's like kind of, it's not bad, it's understandable, but it kind of really misses the point. And I think that's where often people misunderstand each other. If you talk to someone in like, you know, traditional media that writes for a newspaper and stuff, or work for a radio, it's like the way Howard Stern is so dismissive of podcasting. And it's like, dude, it's the same thing that you're doing, but just the future of it. So people get really tied up, I think, in platforms rather than just being like, here's great content. I learned something from this. Here's fun, interesting content. And I escaped my problems for half an hour by using this. And it's all great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think totally. That, like, obviously, reading is important in terms of function. You need to get to a point where you can function in society by reading. Beyond that, I do think that it's overrated. I think that, so going back to the whole YouTube thing, like, just imagine somebody getting into woodworking. Like, I would say videos are infinitely better than reading if you're trying to learn something like woodworking or something that's predominantly a visual medium, because it's so much easier to explain through visuals than through words.
Right. Yeah, I think so.
Can you imagine a text-only description of one of your projects?
Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, then pick up that piece, flip it over, and then use your offhand to support that and guide it through the... Yeah.
But that's also comparing an encyclopedia to just Googling something, right? That's just like what we're talking about. The platform newer is just more efficient and better.
But I think I think that video is quickly eliminating that idea, because so you're going to Google it and you're probably going to find a video.
Yeah.
Like that's going to be the result of that Google search.
But you know where
I think that's true.
You know where reading might be more efficient? For explaining like what finishes to use for what wood combinations. I think that's a place where a well-written article might get the information quicker, because you can skim to the part, especially if it's bullet pointed, where, you know, it's specific to the circumstances that you need. Whereas a video, you might have to be scrolling around a video to try to find, oh, well, I'm waiting until he gets where he's talking about the combination of polyurethane and walnut, right? That might be in the middle of a 16-minute video on that. So I do think there is a role for text in instruction for some of those really technical, precise things where you can, you know, go back and be like, oh, it's always this 1-2 combination of thinner to polyurethane or whatever it is that you're doing. So I do think written instructions are incredibly important in specific cases and far superior to video in the right circumstances.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is there's not one medium that's always best. It's just different things cater to different situations. To go back to one other thing that I was just thinking, to go back to where this whole conversation started. I remember...
Wait, where did this conversation start?
With the AR party and like...
Got it.
I was saying that I feel like those kids are being punished because they essentially don't have the resources that the other kids have. So I remember for 7 just finished kindergarten. And one of the last things they did for the year was they had this party or like a parade where the parents could go. And they had... The kids all had to build a car like out of cardboard. And then they did a little parade where they walked around and you saw every kid's car. And I remember after saying like, they should have done this at the very beginning of the year and use it as a tool to see what kids are probably going to need more resources from the school. Because you can see okay, this kid has an insanely awesome car. So obviously his parents are very involved and helping. This kid has like nothing. So his parents probably didn't help at all. maybe we need to throw a little bit more resources here.
Mm, yeah.
Just a thought.
Maybe a good gauge as well on like where the kid is, you know, above average or at average, right. where they're below. Yeah. Like, oh, this kid seems to be like, his car doesn't drive straight, but look at those flames. This kid's creative. Yeah. You know, and then the other kid is like, well, that thing is ugly, but it beat everyone else. Like, right. That's the science kid.
You can kind of gauge what's going, like a project like that, where like, obviously yeah. they're doing the work at home. You can kind of gauge the kid's abilities and a little bit of like, what kind of resources he has at home. Well,
that's what standardized testing is, Chris.
I guess.
You just got a very unstandardized test.
Yeah. I want to think like outside the box. All right. Yeah. What's your obsession, Mike?
Man, that's a very LA school thing to say, though. I'll tell you that much.
My obsession. In Oklahoma.
Nah, man. Oh. Yeah, mine this week. So a little preface to my obsession is I went to my local bank and I got my affairs in order financially. I started a Roth IRA.
Are you planning to talking, die?
No. I got my Roth IRA started. I've divvied up my money to different accounts where they need to be instead of everything I own sitting in my checking account. And I've also been talking to the mortgage lady at the bank. And so I'm trying to get everything moving towards figuring out, you know, just a few things like how much money I have, how much money that affords me to spend on something and just getting the pre-approval process started, because aside from student loans, I have zero credit history. And so I got a credit card so that I can start building that up. You know, just some things to where as I'm 23 now, I'm getting close to that 25 year mark where I feel like by 25, you need to have kind of the basics of life figured out at that point. And so I'm trying to get there. But well, all that to say,
let me put a stamp on that. You definitely don't need to figure it out by 25.
No, I just mean like not sinking in terms of like,
yeah,
just like how much money do you have in your PayPal account? Oh, they shouldn't be there. That definitely needs to be in a savings account or something like that. You know,
PayPal should not be your piggy bank. I mean,
for
so many reasons. I mean, just from a security standpoint alone.
No, but it's just a thing where working with sponsors, there's a certain few sponsors that I work with that just pay me regularly through PayPal, and I just never touched it because I looked at it as I'm not going to spend that money, so it's better being there because it's basically like money I don't have until now when I was able to transfer a lot of money into my savings. So,
all right. Listeners, send Mike your recommendations for wealth management and financial planning podcasts.
Yeah. Well, I actually have a couple that I was recommended by a friend of mine. And one of them is called, this is not my obsession, but I'm going to go ahead and shout it out. It's called Deeper Pockets. It's great. They talk investing, they talk real estate, and they have a bunch of guests on who basically do that. You know, whether it's a real estate guy or an investing guy, he just comes on, they ask him questions and it's sort of like a little round robin type of thing. So that's a good show. And I would suggest that I've only listened to a couple episodes, but so far so good. But it's funny. Yeah, my obsession this week is a YouTube channel and it's called Graham Stephen. Now, Graham Stephen has a lot of great information. He's a young guy that basically took a small amount of money, invested it well, did the kind of real estate thing, and basically was like, this is how I became financially independent at a young age. That's sort of what his shtick is. Like, he's not crazy rich, but, you know, he started out very modestly and now lives very comfortably, which is, I think, very useful information for a lot of young people. But his channel, aside from just being very, very useful or whatever you want to say, is the exact reason that I appreciate having sponsors so much. Because it's almost alluding back to what you're talking about, Ben. We're not chasing the algorithm. We don't have to make these stupid clickbait thumbnails and YouTube video titles. Like, we're able to just explore an idea, whether that's making a concrete mold and breaking it in half and turning it into a coffee table, or figuring out how to make heated concrete furniture. Like, all these things, they're not super clickbait and they're not necessarily appealing to the algorithm really, really well. But because we have sponsors, our sole source of money isn't that built-in YouTube revenue. So that is like my only critique that I really have towards Graham Stephen is, bro, chill with the titles and whatnot. Like, just give me some good, straightforward information. But I also understand that he's got to sort of appeal to I don't know, the algorithm or play the game, whatever you want to say there. So he's got some good info. I think his best videos that he's done is he's sort of gone around to people that have a certain amount of investment properties. So he did a couple videos with a guy. He's like, yeah, I own, you know, 12 rentals here in the city. Let's go through them. We'll talk about, you know, my experience with it. And you just get a lot of good takeaways, right? It's not necessarily a how-to. It's more like a podcast. He's done that with people that, you know, have around 10 properties, a few properties. He did one with a guy that had like 100 properties. But it's just good info, stuff that I've been looking for. And yeah, he also has a video on how he was able to like get a Tesla for $80 a month for something or another. I didn't watch the video. I skimmed it.
He was able to take a lot of
tax credits and incentives to where he almost got a free Tesla. Basically, like where he lived and all of his situation just was the perfect like puzzle combination.
He's the modern day version of Mike. I don't know if you'll remember this. Ben probably will, but there used to be this guy that had, I think he had like exclamation marks all over his suit, and he'd be like, "The government will pay you to do this."
That asshole.
Yeah, he's the this is the modern day version of that.
Yeah, a little bit, but yeah, I think there's a lot of fluff towards the content, but overall positive stuff. And I'm sure I'll find other creators that maybe connect with me more, kind of more like on a personality or content style way. But this is a good entry point, at least for me, into this broad genre of doing things with your money on YouTube. So yeah, that is it. You guys got anything else you need to talk about or anything else you need to mention to the people?
No, I'll just point out the irony that you're learning about this stuff through podcasts and YouTube.
And not books. Reading.
Yeah.
Bro, I'm trying to get that new information. I don't want a book that came out 10 years ago. I want that podcast that dropped yesterday.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you guys for listening. We genuinely appreciate you making us a part of your kind of weekly routine, whether that's in your workshop or in your car ride home, sitting at your desk, whatever you're doing. We appreciate it greatly. If you don't follow us on Instagram, we are at Modern Maker Podcast collectively, but we don't post there a ton. That's sort of where we manage our challenges and answer listener questions and kind of do our housekeeping in a way. If you want to reach out with us for a burning question or a topic idea, it's better to do that individually. Ben is at Benjamin Ueda. Chris is at Four Eyes Furniture, and I am at Modern Builds. All those will be down in the podcast notes below. Thanks, guys. We appreciate it, and we'll see you next time on the Modern Maker Podcast. Bye, everybody.
See ya.
Bye.